the subject of synchronicity is one that, on the one hand, I think may appear to some people as some kind of strange psychological gobbledygook, on the other hand, I think that even in psychological circles, and I hope I'm wrong about this, it would seem to me that in more recent years, I have seen very little mention made of synchronicity in some of the Jungian lectures and seminars of which I get the literature. It would almost seem as if various other subjects within the depth psychological field, certainly the Red Book and others have displaced this subject. And of course it always has been pretty much to everybody, including myself, a very mysterious subject. But then some of us are of the kind who like mysterious things. That's why we are in a mysterious place like here, you know. I am very I'm very pleased with myself, at least up to this point, that I have made now another effort to bring this subject out into the open and perhaps to present it in a way that might be useful and not ordinarily available. Now, to introduce this strange subject, I will start with a quotation from someone who I don't think is ever connected by anybody with synchronicity, namely Immanuel Kant. I'm just looking around. Is anybody still left here tonight who speaks German? Oh yeah, ja freilich, okay, so then I'll say it, you know. This is Kant's famous quotation about his identification of the source of moral inspiration, because, you know, he became noted for his famous categorical imperative in ethics. And so introducing that, he has this saying, der gestirnte Himmel über mir und das moralische Gesetz in mir soll meine Richtung werden. Now I'm sure all of you have understood this very well, and I don't need to translate it, but I will. And it means that the starry heavens above me and the moral law within me shall give me direction. That these are the two things that he considered to be the sources of direction, in this case, in the ethical field. However, the meaning, I think, of the sentence can be extended from subject of ethics, I think, to others, in the sense that if we really look at the experiences of life, we will find that there are two sources of, at least let's say, the more worthwhile experiences of our existence. And these two sources are within us, as Kant says, and outside of us, you can't be much more outside than the starry heavens, for heaven's sake, you know. Quite a few of you have been with us the last month or so when we were, for instance, discussing a very famous ancient Gnostic poem, I always call it a poem, the so-called Hymn of the Pearl. And some of you may recall there that in this is the story, you know, symbolic story of a soul from the high transcendental regions who comes to earth and then undergoes a certain experience of amnesia, of forgetfulness. He forgets where he came from or why he is here, and then he receives a letter to awaken him to his true nature and to his destiny. Now, this metaphor which we dealt with there, and which I think is a good metaphor probably to bring up in various contexts, this metaphor indicates that we are reminded in various ways throughout our lives. Well, what are we reminded of? We are reminded of the purpose and the meaning of our lives, which we pretty much have to be reminded of and to discover, because it's not a recognition that comes to us very naturally in the course of our early lives. So the reminders, and they are the reminders of real meaning, and that's really the term that C.G. Jung uses for the explication of as much as one can explain of synchronicity, meaning, this deeper meaning is revealed to us, well, probably primarily, or at least if we look into the various traditions, this would be the source that we are reminded of all the time, whether spiritual traditions of the West or of the East or of anywhere, when we make contact with a really deep, ordinarily perhaps not very active and available center of consciousness within ourselves, then we receive some revelation of this meaning. And it is for this purpose that all kinds of spiritual activities, meditations and prayers ritual work have been devised over the ages, is to somehow, as the Zen, one of the Chinese Zen patriarchs said, to wipe away the dust from the mirror of ourselves. This, of course, let's say, is at least theoretically fairly well known to us because of all the traditions that proclaim it. But there is also another source, and this should not be envisioned as an alternative source. Nothing can replace the often still and often small and yet extremely important voice of the deeper self within. That's a very, very, it's an all-important factor. But there is another. It doesn't replace the former, but it is there. And it is quite helpful. And this is, curiously enough, of course, both of these sources are, shall we say, mysterious. Why are they mysterious? Well, probably because in the ordinary, not very conscious course of life, we don't make much contact with either of them. We are not in touch with our inner reality, And we are not really in touch with the disclosure of reality and of meaning from outside either. But to come back to disorder, it means that somehow in the in the world that is external to us, in the kind of reality that we contact with our senses, there are strange signs. The ancients in Latin would refer to a sign as an omen. Omen. And we still have the word in English language too, that something is ominous because it signifies something. There are signs that appear in the external world that pop up, so to say, in unusual ways, and that when properly approached and by way of that approach understood, can reveal meaning to us. So the letter that in the Hymn of the Pearl comes to us from the realm of transcendence is not purely inside of us, but it's also outside of us. And in both places we have to learn how to read the letter. Now, let's say that there's all kinds of ways of looking at this, and it's a very mysterious subject, and that's why I felt that quite a few directions, quite a few angles are needed to illuminate it, and perhaps by being able to do this in several talks these 2 months, we'll be able to accomplish that. We are creatures that are very much prone to one-sidedness of consciousness. This is it's a good word. C.J. Jung used it a lot, and it describes a direction, an orientation of our consciousness, which goes to one particular thing and not to any other. And because of this unidirectional tendency of it, it reveals to us only partial meaning and partial realities. When we are suffering from a one-sidedness of consciousness, we never apprehend reality as a whole, but only as a part. I don't think we really need to be told that too much, because we live in an extremely one-sided culture. That one-sidedness being an outer-directed, extroverted, which is the psychological term for it, direction of our consciousness. Once again, this is an understandable and natural phenomenon of the human being, because we might see when we come forth, even physically, when we come forth from our mother's body, we now are here to somehow get along in this weird external world. And if you observe little children, then you see that they have a hard time with it. They are interested, they are trying to explore, they are trying to see, they are trying to smell, they are trying to taste, which is all of those are important ways of learning about the outer world. And I always appreciate it when a little child wants to taste it. You know, Does it taste good? Can I eat it? It's a very important consideration in this world, you know. The gustatory exploration is quite important. And you know, all of these sort of pseudo-asceticisms that we run into, and I hope I'm not stepping on anyone's, predilections in that regard, but you know, we have veganism and we have this and we have that, all of which is in part calculated to take away from that particular way of experiencing things. So I think tasting things is very important, and things that taste good are worth eating. This is the great revelation of wisdom that you are getting this evening. You know. In any event, that is just obviously just one aspect. So, because our development from early childhood on is from within outwards. You know, out there is the reality. Out there are the interesting things and so forth. But it can be, and it is, overdone. And when it becomes the predominant keynote of a culture, as it, I believe, is in our culture, then we are faced with a one-sidedness, and that one-sidedness in turn deprives us. In fact, that's just a minor feature of the situation. It would seem, according to kind of developmental psychology of a deeper nature, that we are perhaps sort of preordained for the most part to explore the outer world kind of for the first maybe half or so of our lives. But when we come to middle age and so forth, the clock strikes, if indeed we haven't heard it striking in some way before, to now look at the other reality. So outward and then inward. And if we can do that and truly gain a lot of meaning that way, then we have led a life of worthwhile true discovery and discovery of meaning. So we might say that all throughout the spiritual history, let's say, of the world, people have been to some degree or extent aware of sort of two kinds of reality. And one of them you might call the world of being. The world of being is that which transcends the external world. Not only does it transcend the physical world, but it even transcends much of the more superficial layers of the psychological world, the ego world, the world of thinking, of feeling, of intuition, of sensation. That is the. So beyond these, there is something that we might call the world of being. Contrasted with that, outside and perceptible to our senses, is the world of becoming. And we might even call it the world of becoming and unbecoming, because things become and unbecome all the time. If you sort of observe what is going on in the world, new things are coming forth all the time, and other things are vanishing and disappearing. It is a constant flux of becoming and unbecoming. Now, the world that we deal with externally, and that our culture, forces us so much to be a part of, the extroverted world, the world of becoming and unbecoming, works in terms of these processes by way of something that is called causation. There is a cause and there is an effect. No effect without a cause. That's a very Aristotelian approach, incidentally. But it's true as far as the external world is concerned. That is why when we are confronted with some phenomenon that we don't quite understand, we look at it and say, oh, what made this happen? What was the cause? Because we are so oriented to the process of causation. And that is quite valid. That is the way, the manifest world seems to work. The world of becoming and unbecoming. But what about the other? The other, which is the world of being. And strange to say, and we seldom reflect on that until someone calls our attention, as C.G. Jung called our attention to it in his writings about synchronicity, that there is an other world, there is an other reality, which does not seem to operate on the basis of causation. Things happen. But they don't happen because something made them happen. They just happen. And that's very bewildering. It's so different from what we generally deal with that it's hard to relate to. You might even add to it, there are other features. The world of being, as contrasted with the world of becoming, is not only bereft of the principle of causation, but it is also bereft of the awareness or the consciousness or whatever we wish to call it, of time. Now, how can you prove that? I think we all can prove it very easily when, for instance, we try to remember, it's just a nice little exercise, we kind of try to remember how we were, how it felt when we were probably quite little children or teenagers or something of that sort at a particular time in our lives, especially if there was something interesting going on, and then you can kind of get hold of that and then you judge how it feels. And what you will discover is, if you then ask yourself, oh well, I was there doing such and such, am I still the same person who did that? Am I still the same person who, when I'm not going to go into my own history, but let's say, was doing such and such many more years ago than I care to admit, let's say in my native Hungary or something like that? And at least my conclusion is yes. So in terms of the feeling, in terms of the consciousness, we are the same now as we were then. Time does not influence certain realms of consciousness. Certain realms of consciousness are bereft of time. Time is meaningless there. So that's it sort of indicates this very very interesting duality. Now I don't want to go into more sort of psycho-historical analysis, but let's say it's not a bad thing to remember historically that sort of up to a certain point in the history, let's say, of the Western or Mediterranean culture, the awareness of these two realities, of the timeless, the causeless realm on the one hand, and the time-bound world of causation and becoming on the other, was realized and understood. It runs all through the writings of Plato. You can't read a few pages of Plato and not really come to that recognition. Or the pre-Socratic philosophers too. Beginning with dear old Aristotle, it begins to change. And from then on, it becomes more and more important in the culture. You know, one of the translations of Aristotelian principle, it's a translation into Latin, but I already bugged you with German, so I'm not going to do that. That there is nothing in this is Aristotelian saying, there is nothing in the intellect that was not previously in the senses. Now this is a statement of extroverted consciousness par excellence, you know. But it wasn't always that way. And not only that, but there was always a minority. There was always a kind of a substratum of humanity and of human consciousness that maintained an awareness of the two realities. And that knew that there was meaning, real transformative, inspiring, liberating meaning comes by way of that deeply hidden reality that is inside of us, while at the same time, in a strange and mysterious way, it is also stimulated by certain events and certain data that are outside. Now, this stimulus is what in modern times, I think C.G. Jung published the first paper on synchronicity in 1951. I can tell you exactly where to find the stuff if you are interested. Since C.G. Jung's work has been called synchronicity. And what this means is that in the midst of, sort of worked into, woven into the events of the external world, there is something else. Woven into the world of causality and time and all these other dimensional elements, there is something else. There is a web, a metaphor, of course, I don't take it literally. There is a web of the other. You might even say of the holy other that runs through the external world, unrecognized, unappreciated, undiscovered, but it is there. And then under certain strange circumstances, portions of the web come out and are in your consciousness and in your awareness. Very, very unusual, very, very strange. Now, the signs, the omens. Now, I need to insert a little bit of something because I am known as the old Gnostic, increasingly old, which happens, what are you going to do? In any event, and you know, we Gnostics from the early times on, from the times of the first and the second century, we have always been called, unjustly actually, we are dualists. Oh yeah, all those dualists, oh my gosh. We divide the world up, you know, sharply, the spiritual world and the physical world. And the physical world is no good, and only the spiritual world is good. Of course, at the same time, we have also been accused of, some of the early Gnostics that all sorts of things. They did a lot of magic, like Simon Magus and Menander and people like that. And there are others like Karpokratis that they kind of like to party as often as possible, you know. On the one hand, you know, the Gnostics enjoyed themselves too much, and on the other hand, they were these world-denying dualists, you know. How that can be, I don't know. It can only exist in a hostile, accusatory mind. But let's say the proper position of the esoteric tradition, beginning with the Gnostics and the Hermeticists and the Neoplatonists and then everybody else thereafter, has always been that while the external, the physical, the world of becoming and unbecoming and so forth, it runs on its own. It has a kind of a mind of its own. Newton, the founder of Newtonian original physics, it sort of likened it to a great big clockwork, a great big machine, except that I guess it has been wound up long ago and it keeps ticking and just keeps going. It has its own agenda. And for the most part, that agenda is really not our agenda. And that far I go into the so-called dualist position. But that's not all. In that clockwork, sort of mixed up in the great gears that keep moving around, there's something else. And that something else is the potential that reveals meaning and reveals it by way of synchronicity. Now, it becomes needful for me to define it a little bit. I've been leading up to it now. As this is not exactly Jung's definition, but let's say it's based upon it, you know. Synchronicity is a sign which at the same time has the potential of a powerful revelation of meaning, which comes about when a level of readiness, of openness, of a certain kind of specific receptivity takes place within the human's internal being, in what Jung would call that deeper part of ourselves, collective unconscious, objective psyche, whatever terms have been devised, which are ruled by the self, with a capital S, when a certain readiness and consequent awareness arises here, and simultaneously sin chronos, you know, chronos is time, old father time, who eats his children, you know, only the Greeks can come up with an image like that. You know, that is, you know, time, we are the children of time and we are being eaten up all the time. You know, the old fellow, the munch, 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 you know. Sin means together in time. So when the internal readiness and the external sign arise simultaneously at the same time, then we have a synchronicity. Now, remember a little bit of what we said before. It is not a matter of cause and effect. Not the internal reality is not the cause. The external is not the cause. Neither is a cause and neither is an effect, but they happen simultaneously at the same time. Now, and this simultaneous happening causes a kind of a breakthrough in our consciousness. Maybe not a very big one, depending on the situation. Yet a valuable one. So when this occurs, and most importantly when we are aware of that, then it causes a certain kind of effusion, maybe even explosion of meaning, of deep meaning within the psyche. Now I am tempted at this point, and I guess I yield to the temptation. You know, some temptations one should always yield to. Nice things, you know. That to give you examples, especially, let's say, the examples that C.G. Jung used himself. And I must admit that these examples may appear a little bit tight, but they really are not. And they certainly were not when they occurred. So the real famous one is the one about the rose chafer. Now, the rose chafer in Europe, I guess they got them here too, is apparently a distant relative of the scarab, the sacred, the scarab beetle, of the Scarabaeus sacer, as he's called in Latin, in which is such a big figure in ancient Egyptian lore, the god Khafre. You know, from his name, derived the name, for instance, in German, of a bug. His bug is Khafre. You know, there are a lot of languages, are European languages, and so have ancient Egyptian words in them in various ways. Anyway, that's another issue. In any event, it doesn't even make that much difference. The details don't make that much. A certain patient, woman patient of C.G. Jung, was in his office and telling him a fairly elaborate and quite energized, quite meaningful, you know, powerful dream. You know, there are those dreams that, especially when you tell them, recall them under the proper circumstances, really have, you know, have quite an energy. So this was there was quite a bit of energy to the dream. The lady realized that this was a very meaningful dream, that this was bringing some important message to her. But she didn't quite know what it was. And as they were conversing, Jung looked at the window pane behind him, and on the window was crawling a rose chafer who looked just like the scarab in the dream of the lady. I probably didn't mention that there was a great scarab there. And so Jung contemplated that and pointed to the lady, look at the window, see? And the convergence of her recalling the dream, which was, of course, you know, as real good dreams are, a revelation, a bursting forth of a message from deeply within, and a sign on the outside. The convergence of these two caused a real explosion of understanding, of meaning in the lady, and I think to a certain extent Dr. Jung himself, who participated in that. Now, I regret that I can't tell you what that meaning was, because obviously it was personal to the lady, and therefore, you know, professional secrecy would not allow it to be revealed. But can I'm just showing this as an, and there are of course much more elaborate and complex examples. But what you have here is an internal happening, which indicates a coming forth of something and the readiness for something to come forth, and a confirming external sign, a confirming external event. When these two come together, they cause something. And what they cause is a sort of an explosion of interior meaning. And there are a number of others. I could recount them to you. There were, for instance, these are just some of the early examples that Jung recounts as occurring, let's say, within the analytical process and when dealing with people. But let's say they do occur quite outside of that context also. When the culture at certain historical periods was open to these sorts of things, then people were more responsive to these particular phenomena, and they received a larger number of, let's say, revelations of one kind of meaning or the other because of such events. And as we will see, probably I think a week from tonight, it is on this basis, let's say, that many cultures, and everywhere, from the Australian Aboriginals to the Mesoamerican ancient peoples, to the ancient people of the Mediterranean, of Asia, everywhere there was an awareness of the meaning that is revealed by divination. And since I used that as a principal title of the series, I might as well say something about it. Most of these cultures, certainly the Greco-Roman culture, believed in divinities, gods and goddesses, as they may also be called. Beings that are greater and more powerful and that are capable of bringing meaning and wisdom to humans if they so choose. And so the people were naturally enjoined by their culture to look for signs, to look for omens. And from these omens, they then deduced certain messages and certain meaning for themselves. And of course, a lot of these really count as synchronicities. For instance, I knew a man who lived for a period of time, I think it was in Belize, among the native people. I'm trying to think as to which nation. I think they are probably they are neither Aztecs nor Incas. I can't think of it at this particular point. Doesn't really make all that much difference. Excuse me?
Mayans.
Yeah, Mayans, that's it. So, you see, to me, Maya is a name of a woman. In any event, yes. And so this, for instance, this particular gentleman was there with the Mayas, and the they were getting ready to go on a journey out into the wild for a variety of purposes, physical and spiritual. And so while they were in the room, he was there with them, and they were getting ready, packing up their gear and so forth, a spider fell or jumped off some ledge right into their midst. We would probably be afraid and say, get rid of the spider. So they looked at the spider and they said, oh, a sign. And then they quieted down, and then they said sort of in unison several, we have to go and get spider. Spider was the name of a man in the village. So they in en masse marched over to Spider's house and said to him, Spider, you got to come with us. He says, why? I want to stay. They said, because we have a sign, and our journey is not going to be successful unless you come with us. Huh? And said, all right. So he packed up his own little bundle, and they all marched off, and apparently had a good and a meaningful time. So once again, now, you know, there was a need, apparently, for their company to be complete with that particular individual. And this need was highlighted by the spider. But there had to be an inner awareness, an inner readiness on the part of these people to see the meaning and to act on it, rather than just say, oh, that nasty spider fell down, let's stop on it, which would have been my inclination, I think, if I have been there. I don't do terribly well with spiders. But, so these are the ways that, let's say, archaic, ancient people and so forth are attuned to and responsive to the signs that occur within their lives. And to a very large extent, it's very, very true from what I hear in the literature, and so, for instance, of the Australian Aboriginals, they live by synchronicities. You know, now you might say, is that a good thing? Well, they would certainly say it's the only thing, it's the only way that they want to live, because this gives meaning and direction to their lives. Now, divination, and I mentioned the word divination, ties in with this, and we will have a lot more about that as we go on, is that the being aware of these possibilities, various people throughout history decided, well, maybe instead of waiting for signs to occur like this, maybe we can somehow facilitate the arising of signs. Maybe we can, to use a modern term, maybe we can make synchronicities happen. And making or trying to make a synchronicity happen is the art of divination, of which, let's say, the ancient Mediterranean world, the Greco-Roman Egyptian world was filled with almost anything that you can think of was used for divinatory purposes. And the Greek derived word for that is mancy, M-A-N-C-Y. And so you have this kind of mancy, that kind, and that comes from the fact that the Greeks believed in the mantic arts, divinatory arts. Actually, there were two kinds of divination by the Greeks, Oionistic and mantic. And the Oionistic is where you, it's kind of a pseudo-synchronicity, where people try to figure out certain connections by rational and logical means. I hope I'm not stepping on anyone's toes, but an Oionistic kind of divination is what people have made throughout history eventually out of astrology. Why? Because there's all the figuring out, there's the setting up of the horoscope, there's the angles, all that mental, all that intellectual material. While the mantic form of divination requires a change of consciousness, an arising of a highly energized consciousness. Believe it or not, it's the same word that from which the term mania originates. Mania in Greek, which doesn't just mean madness, but means a highly energized consciousness. So the mantic arts, the mantic divination requires that the person be feel a certain kind of inner inspired excitement over the process. For instance, I always wondered, one of the mancies, one romancy, for instance, is divining by way of the dreams. Cartomancy is by way of cards, and so on and so forth. The wonder where the word mancy doesn't really occur is augury, which is divining by way of the flights of birds. And I always wondered what the heck could that be, because, you know, I look at the birds flying around here and this and that, and I don't see any particular pattern. I mean, oh, that's a nice bird. I love the hawks. They are my favorites, you know. I think the raptor birds are the eagles, hawks, even vultures, the California condor. So these are the most wonderful, to me, they are the most wonderful spiritual symbolic creatures in the world. And of course, the ancients, the Romans and the Greeks said that the birds were messengers of heaven. The eagle is the messenger of Jupiter and so forth. In any event, a revelation came to me when we were in Rome, and I think we were staying outside of Rome in Tivoli, and we came in on one of the local trains, and just as we were exiting from the train station, I looked up in the sky and I thought that I had visions. Hundreds and hundreds of birds of particular species, whatever they were, dark-colored birds, flying around in the most intricate geometrical patterns, making eights, making zeros, it just went on and on and on. And I looked at them and said, aha, that is where augury comes from. There are in certain circumstances, there are real intricate patterns. And these patterns, in turn, like meditating on a mandala or so forth, can inspire meaning. Now, as you undoubtedly divine by now, since we are talking about divination, we are touching a very mysterious, a very intricate and very peculiar subject. And it will require a lot of inquiry of one kind or the other. But what is probably more important than anything else in approaching this subject is that we have to come to an internal conviction, an internal realization, that being that there is something in life, in our life, but in our life also as it relates to other lives and as it relates to the various realities, that is here, it is not only willing, but eager to convey revelations to us which will be conducive to our spiritual welfare, which will make us, as we depth psychologically one says, more conscious, more aware of the interdependence, the wholeness, the meaningfulness of things. All around us, there, the atmosphere literally vibrates with a desire to make our lives more meaningful, more rich, and more free. But we have to be aware of that, and we have to collaborate and cooperate with that. And this is, we need therefore to do a certain work with our consciousness of receptivity. If our lives are dull, I don't mean an occasional dullness, for heaven's sakes, of course, that's always there. But if on an ongoing basis our lives are dull and uninteresting and unexciting and meaningless, this is in large measure the result of our lack of receptivity, our lack of responsiveness to the desire of these forces that are about us and inside of us, and that want to, they really want to reveal themselves and to exercise a messengership of deeper meaning to us. And the particular part of this is the synchronicity principle. And I will, you know, give you more details about Jung's explanations of it. And by the way, you can find that there are two essays. A short one, which was published in 1951, and a much longer one, the original one, that short one was published in the Eranos yearbooks because it was a lecture of Jung at an Eranos conference, and then the longer one, which he wrote later, and both of them combined are present in the eight. I'm quite sure it's, but I could look it up, the eighth volume of the collected writings together. That's where you find them there. So what C.G. Jung has done by enunciating the synchronicity principle, let's say, in the second half of the 20th century, and now we're in the 21st, he brought back into the potential focus of people, the the mystical fact, as probably Rudolf Steiner would call it, that's one of his words, the mystical fact that we live in an environment, internal environment and external environment, of great and helpful and liberating and loving meaning. There is something here that is trying to make our lives more meaningful than it is. And if we cooperate with it, if we open up ourselves to it, if we treat the potential revelation of meaning in a reverent and receptive manner, then it will come to us. And certainly the awareness of the synchronicity principle and its, let's say, its study to the extent that it can be studied will be immensely to our benefit. Now, I have to conclude shortly. There are various difficulties. And one of them is that we are so grounded in the causality principle and other processes of the external world, that it's very difficult for us to switch gears, so to say, in consciousness to the realm of meaning. And by the way, what I'm talking about here, just to be a little bit more precise about it, it's not the kind of thing that in a mundane sense we often call meaning, namely that this means that. That's not the kind of thing. But you know, all of us has had the experience at some point or the other, maybe when a synchronicity of some sort occurred, or maybe for some other reason, maybe in a meditation, maybe in a nice sacramental ritual that we Gnostics like, of all of us, something inside says, this, there is something here. That's what it is. Truth, reality, love, direction, meaning. All of this together is the kind of mystical meaning that I am referring to. And really it, I can't state it in any other way, but that experiences of that sort really and truly make life more meaningful. I would say, just by the way of a little kind of personal confession, you know, I came to this place actually to the Theosophical Society even before, you know, when we got this particular place in 1950, around 1955. And it was right in this place where some of my early revelations of meaning really occurred. And I... You know, when you get old, you remember things that happened many decades ago. You don't know what the heck happened yesterday. Or maybe even this morning. Probably because nothing terribly important happened. So, you know, this is part of the rationale of the way memory works. Your memory says, your soul says, short-term memory, what's that? Why should I remember what happened this morning? Nothing important happened this morning, you know. Why should I worry about my phone bill? You know, it's not important. Of course, I won't have a telephone if I don't pay, but that's something else. Your memory zeroes in on things they may be long, long time ago and says, at that time something really meaningful happened. And there is... Jung was right, that is really the best word in which you can explain it. You have some of these experiences, you get up, now Now I understand. And it's not understanding of some kind of rational process or some kind of... It's the understanding of an ineffable interior reality or transcendental reality which is transcendent and yet it can manifest here. And, you know, I don't want to conclude with anything else, but trying to convey to you how wonderful, how important, how exciting, how creative that sort of thing can be. It is really a wonderful objective for our activities and for our lives. And if our being together here and introducing this subject in this manner has brought us even a tiny bit closer to that objective, then my efforts and yours have been greatly rewarded. And that is what I hope for, and that is what I pray for, and I thank you very much for being here.